Is that better? Hello. Testing, testing. Come in London. Hello, London. Come in London. Hello.
Excellent.
Yes. Good. Diving into the news. All right. We have heard from the debate commission or whatever the name of that group is. By the way, why do we need those people? They have established the new rules for the debate that'll be on Thursday. The president and the vice president, I believe, will be in the same room. Correct, Tom?
Yeah, I assume so. I hadn't heard otherwise. The main difference...
Separated by plexiglass.
I hadn't heard anything about the plexiglass.
I would just assume plexiglass. And then they would have the social distancing and everything else. And then Christine Welker, is that her name? She's from NBC.
Yeah,
she will be the bias moderator that will give cover to Joe Biden. And we'll follow up with Donald Trump.
You sound like you're on the Trump campaign. Get this.
Listen,
Jason.
Most people in the media are liberal, and most people in the media are liberal. Most people hate Trump that are in the media. That's a given. Trump does have to debate these people when he has conversations with them, or at least screams at them. The last great moderator I remember watching, I thought, was Jim Lehrer. I thought Jim Lehrer, although he was probably liberal and probably, I don't know how he voted, I thought that guy had an interesting curiosity. I think Chris Wallace, you and I are both in the same boat. I think Wallace is probably the best that's out there right now. It was not a debate what they were doing before. But I thought if Wallace could have done what Wallace does, it would have been a more interesting evening for everybody.
That's interesting that you like Jim Lehrer, because, I mean, he's a PBS guy. Everybody thinks PBS guys are so boring. But maybe, with boring comes a lack of a sense of a partisanship. The Trump campaign is complaining about all sorts of things about this debate. Bill Stepien is unhappy about the fact that the mics are going to be turned off. And they say, how dare we have mics controlled by somebody else? But when you hear about how the mics are going to be controlled, it's really not too invasive. For every 15-minute segment, each candidate gets 2 uninterrupted minutes when the mic is off on the other side. Then, for the next 13 minutes, it can be a free-for-all, and depending on how the questions go. So it's just opening statements for each of the 15-minute segments. That's not too bad. The second thing people complained about was, you got that biased moderator. She's a White House correspondent from NBC. And even Jason Miller, who is a very good spokesman for the Trump campaign, says he thinks she's fine, she's solid, he knows her, that she's a straight shooter. So even within the campaign itself, there are some people that are just taking pot shots because she's with the media and not specifically her, and there's somebody in the campaign that defends her. And then the third thing,
I would not want somebody from Fox like Steve Doocy to be doing someone like that, or what's his name? Who's the guy incapable of original thought? He's got a radio show.
Ryan,
you hate
Kilmeade?
Him.
Sean Hannity?
Hannity. Like, imagine Hannity.
Yeah. But see, that would be like having, talk show hosts, I think, like you and me, we have a lot of liberty to be very opinionated in all this. It's the news departments that are meant to be. That's why it's Chris Wallace and not Sean Hannity. That's why it's Kristen Welker instead of Rachel Maddow or something. It's like there's a distinction to be made there. But let me get to the third point then. Bill Septian was complaining about, hey, wait a minute, I thought this was going to be on foreign policy. And it wasn't, and there was never anything that indicated that. It always said the questions and topics would be determined by the moderator of each of the debates, which both camps had signed on to. But Bill Septian then is now going back and saying, wait a minute, traditionally that has been the case. And that is interesting because, he came from the Chris Christie thing. I'm wondering if he just... Because he's the campaign manager after they got rid of poor Brad Parscale, who's having his own personal problems. But when Bill Septian came on board, I'm wondering if he was just kind of assuming things that because of whatever. I don't even know if that's true, if it's in the past. They used to be divvied up in terms of focus. If he just assumed that was going to be the case, and so now he's kind of yelping on that score. But I think it's going to...
I think if you...
Go ahead.
I think that was what the cases were. I think it was the last one. They would talk about foreign policy sort of stuff. And that's where Mitt Romney said that Russia was our greatest adversary. And that's when Barack Obama's great line was the 80s called. They want their ally back, or they want their something issue back. Yeah. The president has had an opportunity to sound off on this.
Okay. Another real great one. Another great one. Kristen Welker. She's a radical Democrat. Look at them. They're getting angry. She's a radical Democrat. She deleted her entire account. Everything is deleted. But I've known her. She's been screaming questions at me for a long time. And she's no good. But I figure, what the hell? She asked you a question. How did I do the other night against one that was worse? She was worse. Savannah.
Not a way to pick up suburban women's votes, I'd say. Going after two. Oh, man.
Yay. Did they get to control each other's microphones?
Shut up, man.
Will Joe Biden be asked about his son, Hunter?
Well, it's not in the topic. So here's how I think he's going to interject what I think is a suspect story. We'll put it that way. Donald Trump will bring it up. So then the question is,
yes,
will it be brought up in a kind of an antagonistic way that he's just taunting him, that it needs that Biden can just ignore it and turn to Kristen Welk for whatever question she's going to ask? She might, if he interjects it and he ignores it, she might say, well, you know, that is the latest gambit. You know, the Trump campaign thinks that you are, you know, hiding something. I don't know.
I heard Rush Limbaugh talking. I wanted to see if he was going to be talking about his cancer at all the other day. And somebody asked him about the debate and his take on the last one. And he was a little hesitant, but he did reveal that he knew the people that had given Donald Trump the advice, that he had offered them assistance preparing Trump for the debate, and they passed on his help. And he said, I can tell you what they told him to do, and I'll tell you that it didn't work. They told him, Joe Biden will become flustered and will not be able to put thoughts together, and he will end up making those at-your-table sort of Caesar salad word salads that he does if you get him flustered. So fluster him. Be constantly poking at him. Poke, poke, poke. Get him to get angry, and then you'll get him to get distracted. And that was the advice that he was given. And as you and I said after watching the debate, that if they had, you know, could ring a bell and go back to a neutral corner or go back to your corner and get new advice, they might, okay, all right, remember we told you to do that? Stop doing it. It's not working, right? But you could tell Rush Limbaugh was disappointed in the advice that he felt his man, Donald Trump, had been given, because it didn't serve him well. It didn't knock Biden into loopy town, and all it did was made Donald Trump look like the screaming guy, you know, sitting on his front porch yelling at people walking by.
And the word is in the debate that he is going to be different this time out.
Yes.
I mean, he's not going to be so. He may be chomping at the bit right now saying, oh, you can't turn off my mic. But I think that my guess is they wouldn't need to control the mics, because he realized that kind of strategy backfired on him. So,
yeah. Hey, speaking of Rush Limbaugh, Jacob, can you just get that, as long as we're on that topic? Yeah. Can you just go grab that sound? Rush was talking about his cancer is not moving in the direction he had hoped for.
It's tough to realize that the days where I do not think I'm under a death sentence are over. Now, we all are, is the point. We all know that we're going to die at some point, but when you have a terminal disease diagnosis that has a time frame to it, then that puts a different psychological and even physical awareness to it.
Wow.
You hear that from everyone, that all of a sudden then time becomes something that is not at your disposal, but it's disposing of you. And it's Tom, you and I at my age, 58, although my teeth and hair don't look it, you begin to hear more and more stories of, oh, did you hear about so-and-so? And did you hear about such-and-such? So Jeff Bridges yesterday announces that he has cancer, right?
Yes. I think, it's especially, go ahead.
No, no, you ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, especially when you get to be our age, you get to be around 60, then you start, you know, becoming aware of friends who have these diagnoses and die. And it's like, this is going to be our life, John, from here on in, is that more and more of our friends are, you know, going to pass away, and we're going to be among them at some point. And it, like, it definitely gives you perspective. It gives you focus. It gives you, you know, it brings, in some ways, in an awful way, it brings life more, you know, vividly to your, you know, sort of consciousness at the same time that you're aware of it. That was very, you know, I mean, I think Rush Limbaugh's politics, I think personally, are terrible. But to hear him speak that way is so authentic and so moving. I wonder, he probably wouldn't do this, but I think because he's so articulate, if he talked about what it was like to be him facing death, every day on his show, if he just took like a 15-minute segment, I think that would be not only, you know, interesting, you know, just because of a celebrity, somebody we know, somebody famous, but also because he is so articulate, he could really, you know, bring to words what a lot of us are going to be going through sooner rather than later, depending on our age. I think it could be very helpful, and he could inspire millions that haven't been inspired heretofore from Rush Limbaugh.
It's interesting you say that. Yes. I listened to the full segment where he talks more explicitly about his kind of prognosis, and he talked about why he doesn't do that, or why he hasn't, and maybe he will as he gets closer, and because I think you're making a compelling argument for it. But he ultimately says his whole career, he calls it bleeding on the audience. He doesn't want anything to be about him too much. And so that's why his entire thesis has been that he doesn't want it to make it about himself, and that's why he doesn't do that.
I would argue that what he's going through right now is so universal that everybody, you know, he's not bleeding on us. It's like we are all going to be facing that. We're all going to be dealing with it. That would be very, you know, emotionally powerful and, you know, not about him. It's about all of us and our condition.
Yeah, and his 40 or 50-year career in radio is coming to an end, and it certainly steals a man's mind to know that, you know, time is not your friend anymore. So to see what happens to him. I think I told you the story about running into a guy I hadn't seen in a long time, but he recognized me, and I had done a story on him in Evening Magazine, and we're passing the quick, you know, hey, how's it going? I haven't seen you in such a long time. He said, great. I said, well, great. Why so great? I've been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I said, and that's great. Yeah, it's great. And hey, can I buy you lunch? Sure, I'm going to have a tuna sandwich. I normally sit right here. I said, Rye, come here. Rye's like, what are we doing, Dad? I said, we're going to have lunch. It was early for lunch, but we sat down. And I had the guy walk me through it. I said, tell me about the day you got the diagnosis. And I want to know the weather. I want to know where you parked. I want to know everything. I want to know when it got around to great. And then he said, for about 3 weeks after the diagnosis, I went through everything that you expect. And then one day I woke up and I realized, I don't care. I don't care what you think. You can judge me however you want to judge. I'd let it all go. I let everything go. Nothing mattered other than my kid, my daughter. That was it.
Very similar thing. I had a close friend, literally my age, a cousin, Dan Coward, and I talked to him. It was fascinating. After he found out he had, you know, sort of given up the last treatments, and so he would be dead within 6 to 9 months or something. And I was talking to him about it, and I said, "So when you wake up, I mean, does it just feel like there's this anvil on you, like weighing you down?" And he says, "It's the weirdest thing, Tom. It's just the opposite. I drive by my neighbor and he's dragging out his garbage cans, you know, and he's doing bills. He says, I don't have to worry about that, you know? All of the
I'm free.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm free.
So Yeah. Yeah. So except for the personal connections, you know, the family members and all, and how sad it's going to be. But that part of being relieved of all the duties and responsibilities and expectations of life leave you. Yeah. And there is a sense of liberation. Now, I'm sure in your case, in your friend's case, in my cousin's case, if they didn't have to have that diagnosis, that'd probably be their preference. But still, there is something freeing about that. And I hope Rush is going through that too.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess when you are sort of thinking you're going to beat it, and they give you the odds, you know, 7 in 10, you think, well, I'm going to be one of the 3% or the 10%. You bank on it. Well, if it's 5%, why can't it be me? But he's right in the sense that everybody gets to that place, but it's just knowing that that's the end right there. So then you try to all of a sudden pack everything in. But the freedom that comes with knowing that no one can judge you. And this guy says, I stopped judging myself because it's not that I was irresponsible with my behavior to other people. I just realized that all the stuff that just held me down and kept me down, all those little things, he referred to himself as, is it the Pillalutians? Who's the, in Gulliver's Travels? What were the names of the guys that had the ropes that had tied them down?
The Lilliputians.
Little tiny guys.
Lilliputians.
Yeah. Those are the things, the worries of every single day that had him tied. And he goes, and I just all of a sudden just stood up and broke out. All the ropes went everywhere, and I was just free of all of it. He's probably gone, but, I mean, what a way to go into the end of it, right?
I hope we're not bleeding all over
our audience.
All of a
sudden, hear traffic. No, we killed him early with my horrible sound quality. Now, Tracy Taylor.
Yeah.
Hey. This was extra annoying, not only the words coming out of my mouth, but the tone tenor of my voice through the crappy phone that I'm working with right here now, Tom. Sorry about that. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Keel Mortgage, the best in the business, the ongoing saga of Nicole, Dory's producer. She's got the condo, Tom. She paid about $8,000 more than the listing price.
Ouch.
But I know, ouch is right, but that's the case for everybody. But she said Keel Mortgage helped her with it every step of the way, and I gave her a raise. And yeah, but that's the kind of guy I am. And then I realized, holy moly, how am I going to make payroll next month? I haven't made any money, so I'm going to need you to help me out, Tom.
Checks in the mail, John.
By the way, are you receiving? You can start to get Social Security, can't you?
Yeah, I'm over 62, but yeah, I'm not.
No. Let's talk about the fact that now with COVID-19 and people working from wherever they want to work, that they've decided they want to live wherever they want to live. So big cities, New York, San Francisco, right? People are leaving and going other places. Saw a really fun piece. A bunch of people leaving San Francisco going to Boise. People in Boise hate them and want them to go back. Or generally the idea is if you left that city because you didn't like that city, don't bring the stuff that you didn't like to where you are now moving to.
I love this article. Yeah, it's about, okay, so let's imagine this post-pandemic world where people can work remotely and live in far-flung places like Cleellum and still work on a Seattle radio station if they want. Where would people end up working and living and wanting to live? Now, I still think that most people that are leaving places like San Francisco and New York and L.A. are probably leaving because the price of everything is so high.
Oh,
that, you know, all things being equal, I'm not sure that people would rather live in Topeka than, say, you know, beautiful San Francisco. But things aren't equal, and so your dollar goes a lot farther. If indeed everybody can live wherever they want to live and are able to work remotely, which isn't everybody, but it could be like half the populace, where do people end up and show up? And right now, a lot of people are leaving the big cities and going to smaller towns. What I found fascinating about this is, so, I mean, ideally, that would be great. Everybody could live if you really like, you know, the arid, desert plains, you know, that might be your kind of a milieu. If you like the water, if you like the mountains, I mean, anybody can live wherever they want. Where would they live? What I found fascinating was the geographical breakdown of politics. That what conservatives want and what liberals want are very different, and what this might end up doing. So they, I don't know if this struck you, but they talked about what conservatives want. They want to live in a big house in a small town and rural area, ideally with people with the same faith. So big house, small town, rural, and same faith. Liberals tend to go for smaller houses, but walkable communities in cities, which obviously are more urban, with preferably with a mix of different races and ethnicities. Yeah. And so they suggest
the same faith, but they want the same faith. The faith is their religion is
government. Same values.
Their religion, values. That's a little faith is their faith is government and that faith. So. So that's what they want to be surrounded by people that worship the same thing they worship.
Okay, yeah. Half of consistent conservatives and 35% of consistent liberals say it's important to live in a place where most people share their political views. So that's another thing. It's kind of reassuring. People want to live where they feel like they're part of that community, at least, especially more so maybe with conservatives than liberals. But what I found great about that is in some ways, everybody can live wherever they want to live. That's good. But this article suggests that if we really did that, we might be siloing ourselves even more. Because if all the conservatives live in these seven, states or seven cities or whatever, and all the liberals live there, that it might actually be less, kind of communal as a country than it is even now when everyone thinks it's so polarized.
My father told me a story when he was working at IBM. He had just gotten a job there, and it was either hired IBM. They wanted to do something that had never been done before. They wanted to do early results. And they wanted IBM to tabulate it all so that you would be able to say, at this point, CBS is calling Pennsylvania for, Kennedy. So because television now is going to get those things out there. So the research that was done through University of Pennsylvania and IBM found the professor said you need to go into a neighborhood and talk to, if there's 200 homes, you only need to talk to five people to get some idea of how that entire neighborhood voted. Now, this is a time when you would have very parochial cities, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, that you knew, all the Russians live there.
Right.
And all the Italians live here, right? And all the Jews are here, and the Catholics are here, and the Blacks are here. And you only need to talk to five homes out of every single one of those in order to get a pretty good idea of how they voted. Right? Mm-hmm. Then they realized, the guy said, not just, that you could expand it out and say 300 homes, five out of the 300 would give you a pretty good idea of how people voted. I think people end up, like, for instance, so I'm living in Clear Elm. Lace and the kids are back in Sammamish, coming back and forth. And when I'm there in Clear Elm, the reason I want to be there is I get a greater sense of nothing against my neighbors in Sammamish. I know more about my neighbors now in just 2 months than I have living 10 years in Sammamish.
That's really interesting because, you've always been anti-neighborly. Because I know my neighbors, I don't know intimately, but pretty well, and recognize them, talk to them, know their names. But you were always like, nobody does that. I think it's great if Clear Elm has brought that neighborliness out in you.
No, I love being on TV for all those years. People, did you like that? I said it made the world a really small place, which is what I liked. You go to the supermarket and people know you and talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have, and the fact that people look out for one another. Dougie, my neighbor, comes over and helps me, with different odds and ends because he's got all these tools, and all I got to do is pay him in beer. The other day, he came in and dug up a huge trench. It was 48 inches deep, and it went all around the back, almost a half an acre. What do I owe you? You owe me beer. And I went and I bought him $250 worth of Coors Light. His garage looked like an end cap at Safeway. But the thing is, I know him, and I know Marla and Dick. I think when you're out there and winter is coming, it's supposed to snow on Friday, there's a sense of everybody's getting ready for it. You know what I mean? It's I can't explain it, but I think that's what it is about a small town like that.
So I guess the question for you is, you always used to mock me because we do Neighbors Night Out, it's like the first Tuesday of August or something, where the neighbors on your block get together. You always scoffed at that. Do you think Clear Elm observes that? And if so, would you join in this time?
They won't. They do Neighbors Night Out every night.
There you go. Okay, good.
I sit in Dougie's driveway and drink beer with him and shoot guns and then burn a big, huge piles of wood and paper.
By the way,
not
does
once
he
a
really?
Year. Yes.
Does he really go by Dougie, or are you just using that to minimize him?
No, he goes by Dougie.
Okay,
which is weird because he doesn't look like a Dougie, and he's replaced the article "the" for the F word. I have never heard anybody curse as much as him. Maybe Andrew, who produces the G and Ursula show, he could give Dougie a run for his money with the F bombs. It is
really
amazing, amazing use of the F word.
All right then.
I don't know if there's a competition for it, but we could try. We'd be able to broadcast it. There are some good teachers that know that it's an extreme and almost virtually impossible for a child to try to learn online without having the interaction of other kids and having the teacher be present and having the feedback. I think society, American society, will certainly be at a great disadvantage in because kids are experiencing school now. So some teachers are stepping way up and breaking out an instrument, Tom, that I know you know something about, in order to keep the kids a little bit more focused.
That's right. Nice profile in the Seattle Times about this one particular teacher, Mr. Escobedo, a 30-year public school veteran who teaches music and band at Eckstein Middle School. He noticed he can tell. So imagine music. I mean, that's one of those hard classes to teach when you're doing everything virtually. And so the live interaction is one thing. Mostly his students produce things that they send him, like 250 like videos that he ends up going through in a critiquing of their performing. But one of the things that he notices when kids are engaged, they allow their picture of themselves to show up on these Zoom like kinds of meetings. And when they're not really engaged, they're still there supposedly, but you can't see them. And he noticed that the one time where everybody zoomed in and was on live is when he started demonstrating the didgeridoo, which is this long tubular instrument from Africa. And I the only reason I know about this is because my brother is a music major, and he ended up learned how to play a didgeridoo, and that really brought kids' attention. So I'm hoping the main reason we can do this story is to sing the praises of teachers everywhere, but also hear a little didgeridoo music so you get a sense of what it sounds like.
That's not just one instrument.
That's one guy by himself. It's like it's some type of French didgeridoo competition, so they were all very competent. But it's one guy.
So, by the way, it's Australia, not Africa. Aboriginal peoples of Northern Australia that were the ones that developed it. It's an amazing sound, and you have to learn this thing called circular breathing, which a lot of people may do in various guises. But this is, you have to get this, and that is like top notch didgeridoo playing. I don't
know.
Let's
hear your brother.
Yeah.
Brr.
Brr. It sounds better, but I haven't mastered circular breathing.
Kenny G, where'd he go to school? He knows circular breathing.
Yeah, I bet he does.
He is in the Guinness Book of Records for holding one note for like 28 minutes long or something there with his little Kenny G horn there.
That was his first, third, and seventh album.
Tom, I was worried about you. You seem like low energy today, but then you pull that one out of nowhere. Good job on that one there. You all right? You sound down. I know I sound a little robotic.
Well, I know.
Are you tired?
I am nervous because I feel like you are going to go away any second, and I'm holding on.
That's
kind of, I'm doing circular breathing inside my heart.
Okay. What then we do, we're going to throw to Tracy Taylor at some point, and then I'm going to run and try to find a better place so that you don't have to do that circular breathing through your heart again, okay?
That would be great.
All right, good.